Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing founder, you know, a founder that has done it multiple times, a founder coming from Startup Nation. And I think that you guys are all and gals are going to really enjoy this conversation, find it very inspiring. We're going to be talking about how to transform yourself and how to really progress as a founder, because as we know, you know, the companies grow quickly and you need to grow in parallel. Then also what to do, you know, to land, when you land in a new country, how to go about it, you know, when you're trying to build a business, as well as raising capital, how things have been changing with raising capital. Our guest today is a raise for his last company, $380 million. So I think that we're going to be able to hear a thing or two in that regard. And then also how to go about achieving product market fit. So a lot of good stuff. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Ran Shaul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So originally born and raised in Startup Nation in Israel. Give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
That was great. Israel is a place to be a teenager. That's what they call it. And it's simple life. I was born and raised in Tel Aviv. Social life was really good back then. It was started to be Startup Nation when I started, and technology was a big deal. Even when I was young, I remember those stories about, if you remember, the big startup started with a company called Amdocs, who actually created the first wave of high-tech technology for the Israeli team. And we were like looking at Amdocs as a way to bridge and bring more technology back to Israel. But back then, it was really good. Spent most of my time there in university and then studied through computer science and industrial engineers. And then eventually started my first two companies, actually. I started in Israel before I came to the U.S.
And even before that, you were in the army, but you decided to take the longer route, 5 years in there. What did you learn about discipline and then also, you know, about some of the entrepreneurial skills?
Yeah, that I did spend 5 years in the army. I ended up doing, you know, the mandatory is today is about 3 years, but I ended up signing for two more because I went to officer and I became an officer and then I became a lieutenant. I learned a lot in that phases. You know, I was 21 and I was already managing, a platoon is about 120 people. So I was managing, and this is there's probably a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. You have to do decision-making process is something I'm still taking here. And basically the ability to understand and have a clear understanding of what you're actually facing. That's something that really helped me later. Some of the principle you're actually learning, the principle of war, is actually really applicable for business management and how to assess and then define a strategy and how to understand if your strategy is well executed and how to execute it in a way that other people follow you. A lot of leadership skill that I was not able to acquire back then in the army, and how to basically make people believe in what you want and make them do what you actually want them to do, was skills that I was developing back there in the army.
So then at what point, because you didn't even work for more than 2 years for a company, you know, I mean, you had it in you. So at what point does the idea of synergy come knocking?
Yeah, I was very late. When I left the army, my friends were already working. Some of them started companies. I was super late. I was like, whoa, I'm back out of the army now. I need to understand what to do. So I had to catch up a lot. I went to university. I started working when I was my third year already. I had no time to spend. I needed to also start making some money aside from being a student. And I spent a little bit of time understanding what and how organization work. I worked at two different IT technology. Back then, the idea of data warehouse, data mining, the early beginning of NLP, the early beginning of AI were just started. And I was always passionate with it. I always felt like, I understand how to use data, I understand how to code, but I also understand how to apply data solution for business problems. And that was my spot. And I realized that I can understand an algorithm, I can be a good algorithm developer, but I will be best if I will take the algorithm and apply it to a business problem. And that was the crossroad of my career. And working for those companies, I realized that I can do it. I can just do it myself. So that's made me feel like I was ready. I was not married back then, didn't have any children. I was just ready to take a risk. And I started my first company with the intention of, you know, make a living. And it became really, really successful company. Eventually, I found myself in Israel, I don't know, something around 100 different people. I was managing different structures all of a sudden. It was my first company. We became very big. And then I got an acquisition offer after a few years. People say, hey, there's a very unique set of skills in that company that I was acquired. So that was something like, usually as an entrepreneur, you don't necessarily get the first thing right. But for me, that actually worked really well as the first company.
Well, I mean, with Synergy, you did quite a bit of good stuff there. I mean, you were on the verge there of data science and big data. You grew that to over 100 consultants. And then you ended up selling it to Nest. What was that process like of going through an acquisition tool for the first time?
It wasn't really, but the company Nest approached us. They were looking to solve a problem. When it's much easier when you have an option, when you offer on the table, you know the other side wants to acquire you. They had a whole strategy around how to take this company public and what to do with this missing piece they had. And the missing piece was they had a lot of technology back then, but they didn't have the connectivity between business algorithm and solving real business problems. So the acquisition process was quite non-painful. Due diligence process, 3 months, argue a little bit about valuation, play a little bit of both sides, kind of like try to make the best of out of that, and then eventually compromise in the middle. And I was ready. I was just ready to move on. And they were ready to acquire. So it was fairly non-painful. I left the company, by the way. A lot of people told me, how did you manage to sell a company and then leave it? But I only had 6 months close and I stayed there for 6 months and then I left the company. The interesting part is that company is still alive. And it's still, as a department who required the sales services, are still doing things so many years after.
So then let's talk about what happened after. Because once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. Now, with the next company, you know, which was Pursway, that was ultimately your bridge to coming to the U.S. So what were you guys doing there? What was the business model of Pursway and how did you decide to come here to the U.S.?
Yeah, the Pursway company was actually, imagine me after the acquisition, I was relaxed. I felt good about what I'm doing in my career. And I met these two guys. Really, really smart people. They just finished the Israeli army from those units that you know that computer science is very strong. And they said, Ron, we have this amazing idea. We can look at data. And then looking at the data, we can realize who is an influential consumer compared to others. Like I said, wait a second. You want to tell me that you can run an algorithm and you want to tell me that based on the data of a bank, for example, you can figure out that Ron is much more influential than other people. I can do a lot with that. I can direct marketing to Ron. I can embrace Mark. Think about it before influencer marketing was even a thing. Think about it in the beginning of social network era. We were talking about really cutting edge stuff back then. People didn't even know that you can actually run algorithm in such a way that you can figure out causality behavior between two individuals and then give it a mathematical score to identify who is an influential guy. I knew there's something unique there. And this is where I decided to join with those two. And I would say if you really contrast to me, it was people that much more academically oriented and I was much more business savvy oriented. And then we come together, we raise money from a very well-known VC, Battery Venture. And the first check we got is where we started the company. And the fun thing about it is after a year or so in the making, I got a phone call from the VC and telling me, Ron, what exactly are you doing? It's like, what do you mean? We're doing a really important thing. We are building a company here. Yes, yeah, but not from Israel. You have to move to the US if you want to build a real important company. You can't do B2B sophisticated AI technology selling remotely. And a lot of people will say that it's different now. You know, if you look at cyber, And there's a lot of good examples that you can do it offshoring and stuff like that. But back then, it was almost impossible to get a big contract. Think about when my client was Bank of America and American Express and Fidelity. Those like the clients I'm talking about, you couldn't do deals without being there in person, making the deal happen. So I was the first one in Persuade to move to the U.S. I moved to middle of December and I landed in a snowstorm in Boston. The only snow I saw before was when I was a tourist, when I went to see snow specifically. There's no snow in Tel Aviv. I went there with a family of two daughters. One of them was 1 year old, and I moved all my life there, started living in America and doing that enterprise sale. Eventually, we grew Persuade very well. Eventually, we sold it to IPG Media Brand. But that's actually was the first time I interacted with, and I realized after that, everyone, I'm telling them, if you want to build something that is going to be monetized in the U.S., you better be in the U.S. to do that. And some people I know disagree with that, but I strongly believe that it's required to understand the market. You have to leave the market.
So what about doing business in the U.S. versus like doing business like you were doing before in Israel? You know, how would you say that things are different? And for the people that are coming here to the U.S. to build something, what piece of advice do you have for them?
Are extremely different. In U.S., you got to be ready. You got to be ready. And I also saw, by the way, I should say that Persuade worked very strongly also in Europe and in Italy and in Spain. And I have Vodafone and I had those companies in my roster list. And making deals in the U.S., you got to be prepared. You can't tell a story that is 70% there. You got to understand the scalability and the conservative, semi-conservative approach that corporate America will take at you. People don't want to take unnecessary risks. This is not a place to, you can do pilots, that's okay. But if you want to be a serious company, you got to have all your checks and balances. You got to invest in stuff that as an entrepreneur, we see as boring, like accreditation or that kind of security things or like everything that, it seems like not that important for a person who just want to build really amazing product. That's one thing that too. Second thing, if to be successful here, you have to succeed here. You can't import an idea or a case study from a different country. We in the U.S., and I look myself as a U.S. now, and I live here for 14 years or almost, we look at what happened in the U.S. as a way, as a references. Yes, you can be successful in other places. You can do it differently, but you have to have a strong success story here. And that's what I realized, that you're pacing yourself. Don't go too fast. Don't try to go to the big marquee account first. Establish your success. Make sure you talk about your case study. Make sure you publish. Make sure people understand. Make sure you have the reference, and then go and build a bigger, scalable, more wider business. So that's the second thing. So if you think about that, it's actually the opposite of how startup wants to work. Startup wants to go fast and break things and move fast and get scalability and get growth. But that's something that I think as an entrepreneur, I learned a lot. Build it in a way that you can eventually scale it, but don't start to do it too fast or too sudden.
So talk to us about timing too, you know, when an acquisition, you know, is the way to go. You know, how should founders think about timing?
I would never plan for it, honestly. Like if you're sitting in an entrepreneur and you're telling yourself, hey, I'm going to sell this company in a few times. Yeah, you can do that. But I honestly think that's not the way to think about it. I honestly think that you need to think about how you build a big company. Is this is going to be a big company? And then if you have an acquisition offer in the way, maybe you are lucky. And maybe you're just going all the way in IPO. The good thing, when I met my co-founder alone, the good thing he always told me, is like, we're not selling anything. We're building a large business to stay here, to never go forever. Like as an entrepreneur, you need to be willing to work forever in the company you create. Maybe there's along the way you can exit and maybe not. But you want to be passionate about what you do long term. You're not doing it for a purpose of, yeah, somebody is going to buy it. In my mind. Now, obviously, there's a lot of people who will say, hey, we can turn a company very quickly sell it in 3 years' time, make a lot of cash. That's a one, I'm not arguing with that approach, but my thinking is much more like, when we started KF and you, I'm going to do this for the next 20 years. That's my mind. Maybe along the way.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Let's talk about that. How do you and Alon, your co-founder, who actually has been on the show too, how did you guys link up?
We had a mutual investor who introduced us. And we met as two Israelis that never knew each other before. And Alon was doing an amazing stuff with online retailer. He created a company called Vroom that went IPO since then. And he was looking for expertise in data and data mining. And I was right after I sold my second company, and I was kind of like looking around, what should I do best? I started actually working with him as a consultant to him in his company. And that's when we got to know each other and we got to see that there's a way of thinking about business problems that we actually really share, and the way to think about vision and how to build product. And even though we didn't come from the right networks, we clicked. Alon is an amazing consumer marketing person. I had all of the ability to monetize algorithms in a large scale. Together, realized that this could be something interesting. And then life happens. You know, I was about to finish my year of when I sold my company. I gave them a year after the second company, Persuade. So about to finish that. And I was like, okay, what can I do? And Alon was exiting his prior company. And we came together and said, what's out there? Like, what is a big problem? Like, this is going to be my third company. Alon already has two IPOs. Like, he was like, why would I need to even work? It's like, what is we passionate about it? Like, what do we really want to solve? We knew nothing about healthcare. And by the way, we didn't understand medicine at all. We came together to this idea. Our third co-founder is Adam Singolda, which is a CEO of a company called Taboola.
He's been on the show too.
He's by itself. It's an own character. He set us together and was like, I have this idea for you guys. What if this could be an automated way of giving you a diagnosis? And we even called it in the beginning was like a second opinion. Let's say you went to your doctor and he told you something and you're like, nah, I'm not sure. Let me check, what is it? And we're talking about way before we even ChatGPT was created, you know, talk about 7 years ago. Now everybody going and asking questions and stuff like that online. But we quickly realized this is a perfect storm. A perfect storm, meaning you have the data, but it's not used well. You have a huge business problem. Health is it's not a business, it's a society problem. And you have a very, very inefficient healthcare system that requires a change. So all of those three things, it was like, yeah, let's build an automated approach, an AI physician. Let's build something that could be as good as doctors. And that's how we started KF.
Amazing. So for the people listening, what ended up being the business model of K-Health? How are you guys making money?
Well, it's been evolved. It was always around the same thing, but the business model has evolved. Now we are a clinical AI primary care platform, and we are offering 24/7 care for our healthcare system partners. So we have, if you're in California, we have a partnership with Cedars-Sinai. You can use an app called Cedars-Sinai Connect, and that will give you an access to 24/7 primary care. And same goes, we just launched today in Hackensack Meridian Health, which is a New Jersey biggest health system. Anyone in New Jersey can download an app and see a physician within 15 minutes. We basically operate those platforms for our partners, and that's how we actually bring the product to market. We also have a direct-to-consumer offering, so you can just use the K-Health solution if you are without insurance or you don't want to, you're not belonging to any health system. So those are the kind of a way of taking K-Health to the market.
So then in that regard too, you guys have raised quite a bit of money. I mean, we're talking about over $380 million. How has it been the journey of going through the fundraising process?
It was fun and then it was not. So in the beginning days, it was, think about it, like before the 2018 thing, we basically started by the idea that we can take a lot of data and we can build an automated AI physician. And the idea of using AI was something in medicine, was something that a lot of people tried, but there was not much data there and was harder to do. And we proved that case. So we were able to raise quite a lot of money based on that. And then COVID started and we grew like crazy, like everyone. And then it was really those 3 months around 2020, I hope I don't get my date right, but 2021, where this whole bubble around IPO burst and money just vapored, disappeared. It became actually quite hard. And in 3 months' time, as an entrepreneur, you had to establish your story from growth to profitability. And among entrepreneur, it's one thing to grow the company and it's one thing to actually create a profit. And that's where we had to change also our perspective. We had to establish our unit economic. We had to make sure that our business make much more sense. And we had to revisit some of our business strategies. And that's where we started aligning ourselves with health system. And since then, it was very, very successful for us. We managed to get 3 big health systems to actually co-manage their patient together. And we're talking about well-established hospitals like Cedars-Sinai or Hackensack Meridian Health that now we're working together in a partnership.
So then how would you say, too, that fundraising has changed over time? Because I know that now you got to be in constant relationship, you know, before you even onboard investors, you know, really getting to understand them. I mean, how have you seen the fundraising landscape, too, changing?
Yeah. If before we had to stay, like we have to sit with an investor or tell a growth story, talk about the category and potentially get a big check. Now it's experts. You get, so sit an investor, you immediately know if this investor is going to be a good fit or not. Like you have to have people like the person who led our last round, Marcelo Clark, is someone that, once when I met him, I realized the person is really interested and really mission-driven and really trying to understand our business and really manage to pinpoint what are the business competitive advantage we have and what's noise and what's hype and what's real. And that is not the different due diligence perspective, but it's the intimacy that we currently think we have with investors and the relationship that we maintain over time, which is different than what we did before, which is mostly like a demonstration and an investor deck, if that makes sense.
So obviously here, you know, let's say when you raise money, you know, people are betting on a vision. People are, and not only people, I mean, the investor, I mean, also employees too. You guys have over 350. So when it comes to the vision, Ron, if let's say you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of K-Health is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Look, we have a big chance here. I'm candidly telling you, this is so broken. Like if you were an engineer and you look at how a primary care visit is done, you were like, you would not believe. Like on one hand, we are as a society able to maybe have an autonomous car, maybe fly people to Mars. But on the other end, the way we look to, we go into a primary care visit and see a doctor is like in the 1950s. We make an appointment in a call center. We go and drive. We have no idea if we need to be there, if this is the right physician. We do manual forms, write things on a paper, and then go see a physician for 2 minutes. And then there's no follow-up. There's not clear what to do. So if we are successful at what we do, we're going to completely reinvent how you going to a doctor. By the way, the doctor is coming to you. So this whole idea is a complete reengineering of that visit. Just so you know, 1.4 billion visit to primary care in America every year. Just think about this number again. 1.4 billion times a person goes to his physician to talk about something. And if we do well what we do, and this is what we're trying now, we're proving beyond any doubt, we're going to drastically change that. That is going to be much more efficient, much more higher quality, and therefore allowing more access to people. The mission of care is access to high quality care. And this ability to use AI and intertwine the AI, not replace necessarily physician, but intertwine the AI between you, the patient, and the physician, and having the ability to elevate that consultation is something that I think we will be remembered of. And eventually, that's what I want. I want people to say, hey, 5 years ago, who would have thought about it? I should have gone to a doctor. This time the doctor is coming to me. I'm just texting and already I have my care plan. I have a follow-up. It's already happening. This has been proactively. People are actually thinking about preventive care, not just about sick care. People are thinking ahead what to do. Like, I'm educated. I know what I have. I know what it could be. I'm as a patient empowered now. I have my medical history. I have a control of my medical history. I'm in control. I'm not this patient wandering around in the system, hopefully for the best. That is what K is trying to do. And now with partners like Cedars-Sinai and partners like Hackensack Meridian Health, we have all the ingredients to really radically change that. And that's what we're doing every day. You know, we're still a small number, but in the mass of thing. But if you think about it, we see 1,000 and some people every day. That's not a small clinic anymore. That's actually quite significant amount of physician, 120 physician working around the clock, 24/7, seeing patient in this new era of AI enabled primary care, clinical AI, primary care practice.
So let's talk about the past now, about doing the show with a lens of reflection. Let's say I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to that time where you were thinking about starting, you know, Synergy, right? Your first company. And let's say you were able to show up and have a chat with your younger self and be able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
That's an amazing question. Thank you. First of all, I would say to my younger self, can you please trust less of your intuition and work more diligently in making decisions? Not everything you think, not everything you convince yourself is correct. Double check, triple check. Understand, listen more. Be less confident in the early days. Validate more. Be more rigorous about decision making. That would be one thing that by the way, I'm still like that. I'm a very intuitive person. So when I feel something, it feels like right to me, but it's not necessarily true. So that's something I would give to give that. And number two, I would think young myself, I would give my co-founder a compliment. Like if I met alone early days, I would have been much better off in my prime. Like not that it was not a success, but I would think meeting the right people and finding yourself going and working with the right type of people and the people that will grow you significantly. And it's good that even if you're a young founder, try your first company. And if your first company works well, great. I was happy that it happens to me. But don't worry. Spend some time with other entrepreneurs. Work for other founders, realizing what they do. Understand the complexity of actually being a founder. And number three is like maybe the most important part. Just be mentally prepared to fail. If you not fail, like you are going to screw it up. Like if you are not mentally prepared and you don't understand that the whole idea of entrepreneur is to fail and then figure out the next step, you're just not cut for it. If you just better work in an environment that is much more, but the entrepreneurship is sore. Like it's really ups and down. Like you wake up in the morning, you wake up the next morning, you close that deal is closed, that deal that you thought it closed, the term sheet is no longer there, something happened, COVID happens, this happens. Like you just need to be ready mentally to understand this is not a straight line. It's not like I'm going to open up a company, I'm going to get my A round, then I'm going to get my seed, my A, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do that. It's just not. You're starting here, you may end up completely different. If you have your mission and your big story, you will align, but your product will iterate so many things. By the way, as part of that is like, I think we build more than we needed for MVPs. Like we're building way too much. We need to put the product much faster into market, test it with real user. The idea of pivoting is not a bad thing. Like people say, oh, you pivot. Like it's not, it's product market fit. It's actually what you need supposed to do until you find the right place that the product is really the product that people want to use. So those are the mindset thing that a lot of people forget. And then it takes an emotional toll on people that are not ready for it. They don't understand why things are changing so much, why it's so dynamic. And that's the key point of what I learned in the past.
I love it. I love it, Ryan. So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Oh, either LinkedIn or just my email, ran@khealth.com.
Easy enough. Well, hey, Ryan, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.